The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia Online. My name is Jason Freeman, and I'm a producer and editor here in the Free Library's Author Events Office, and I'm pleased to be here to introduce tonight's guest, Scott Ellsworth. Scott Ellsworth is the author of Death in a Promised Land, an in-depth look at the 1921 Tulsa Race Massacre, one of modern history's most horrific incidents of racial violence against Black Americans. His other works include The Wind Beneath Their Feet, a history of mountaineering in the Himalayas, and The Secret Game, the best-selling true story of a trailblazing 1940s-era Black basketball team. Formerly an historian at the Smithsonian Institution, Ellsworth has written about United States history for the New York Times, the Washington Post, and the Los Angeles Times, and then many other publications. He joins us tonight with The Groundbreaking, An American City's Search for Justice. In it, he returns to Tulsa on the eve of the 100th anniversary of its infamous racial massacre to offer what The Guardian calls an indispensable and fast-paced but nuanced account of white people's murder of Black individuals and the complete destruction of the Greenwood neighborhood, also known as Black Wall Street. Another review calls it a riveting, painful-to-read account of a mass crime that, to our everlasting shame as Americans, has avoided justice. But also it points out that we have a chance for atonement of one of our darkest hours as a nation. Readers of this book will fervently hope we take that opportunity. Tonight, Mr. Ellsworth will be in conversation with Tracy Mattisack, an award-winning journalist and broadcaster, as well as a great friend of the Free Library and us here in the Author Events Program. Scott, Tracy, thank you both so much for being here, and take it away.
All right. Thank you so much, Jason. Good evening, everyone. And thank you all so much for spending part of your evening with us. We certainly hope that you'll find this to be an enlightening conversation, and we are delighted to have Scott Ellsworth with us. Just want to echo what Jason said about the Q&A icon at the bottom of your screen. If you're not seeing it, you can just sort of toggle your mouse there. And as we have our conversation, you are welcome to enter your questions there, and we'll budget some time at the end of our conversation and get through as many as we can. So all of that said, Professor Scott Ellsworth, welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia.
Thanks. I'm honored to be with you all tonight.
Well, thank you for writing this book. It's called, as Jason said, The Groundbreaking, An American City and Its Search for Justice. It is all about Greenwood and the Tulsa Massacre that took place just over 100 years ago now, as of May 31st and June 1st. Let's start from the beginning. What exactly was Greenwood, and why was it called the Black Wall Street?
Well, Greenwood was a remarkable place. It was an African-American neighborhood district in Tulsa, Oklahoma, in the early 20th century. And it was a particularly vibrant place, a prosperous place. And the reason it was prosperous was in part because the city of Tulsa was rolling in money. In the year 1900, Tulsa was a Tulsi town. It was a little dusty Creek Indian and cowboy town, less than 1,000 people. By 1920, there were 100,000 people living in Tulsa with 20-story skyscrapers, electric streetcars, movie theaters, on and on and on. And the reason for that was the discovery of oil in 1907 nearby. And for a while, Tulsa, the richest small oil field in the world, Tulsa became just a city awash in money, a boom town. And some of that money went to the African-American community. African-Americans made up about 10% of the population in Tulsa. While some were native to Oklahoma or to what had been Indian territory, a lot of the Black folks who lived there had come from elsewhere in the South, from Arkansas and Tennessee and Texas and Georgia, and particularly Mississippi. And in fact, Greenwood was named what it was because there were a number of residents who had come from Greenwood, Mississippi, and the Delta. But this was an astonishing place. You had two movie theaters, the Dixie and the Dreamland. One sat 1,000, the other 750. You had two newspapers in Greenwood. You had all sorts of shops, hardware stores, photography studios, dry cleaners, tailor shops. There were more than 30 restaurants. This is no food desert. Even though you just had 10,000 people living there, you had more than 30 grocery stores and meat markets, as well as two schools, a hospital, more than a dozen churches, you know, a post office substation, on and on and on. And it was a place where the American dream was really working for African Americans in the beginning years of the 20th century. But it was also, Tracy, it was also a place of ideas. They had tons of book clubs and missionary societies, social groups, professional organizations, things like that. Famous speakers like W.E.B. Du Bois came to Tulsa before the massacre and came and spoke. You might walk down Greenwood Avenue. You might hear a Victrola in an apartment building, you know, above your head. Maybe they're playing a blues song, maybe jazz, maybe it's a Mozart sonata. You had a small number of entrepreneurs who did really, really well. The Williams family, John and Lula Williams, they owned the Dreamland Theater. They owned an automobile garage. They also built and owned a three-story brick building, the Williams Building, which had a confectionery, you know, like a candy store, ice cream store on the first floor. The third floor, they rented that out to offices for some of Greenwood's more than a dozen Black physicians and surgeons. There are also African-American dentists and lawyers as well, too. And the family had their apartment on the second floor. But also, there were well over 100 families, maybe 200, who had smaller businesses, but it were businesses that had exclusively an African-American clientele. These could be dress-making operations, small restaurants and cafes, but the majority of Greenwood citizens, probably 85%, there was high employment. There were plenty of jobs for Black people to work in the white community in service jobs as cooks and janitors, ditch diggers, you know, other things like that. They worked, you know, 5 days a week in the white community, but they got a good paycheck. And when they came home, they spent it with Black merchants in Greenwood. And that allowed for the community to thrive.
Yeah. And then that all changed, of course, May 31st, 1921. What happened?
Well, you know, I think it's without going into too much detail, but I think it's important for us to remember kind of what's going on in America in those days. You know, this is still, you know, during the height of Jim Crow. This is a really perilous time for African Americans. Lynching is still going on around the country. While the numbers are going down, the barbarity of lynchings are going up. And in the early decades of the 20th century in the United States, African Americans were burned at the stake while thousands of whites participated and, you know, watched into this. You also had something that was known in those days as race riots, where there's some sort of a racial incident involving Blacks and whites that leads to whites attacking Blacks in downtown areas, and then invading African-American neighborhoods, burning, shooting, looting. These happened in Chicago and Washington, D.C., you know, around the East St. Louis, around the country. And this was also the time of the rebirth of the Ku Klux Klan in 1915. And the Klan was no longer a Southern organization, it was national. The Klan ran state governments in New Jersey, in Indiana, in Oregon, later on in Oklahoma. So you have this very tense time, and you have African-Americans who, particularly World War I vets, Black vets who had fought in France, who had been treated relatively well, and they came back and they were treated poorly in the United States, and they wondered if they were making the world safe for democracy, when are they gonna get some at home? So there were a lot of Black vets that were very much of the belief that when the white murderers came, they're gonna fight back. So this was a tense situation in Tulsa. It was aggravated by other tensions over crime and other things. But essentially what happened is on May 30th, Monday, May 30th, Memorial Day, a 19-year-old African-American shoe shiner named Dick Rowland walked into an elevator in a downtown Tulsa office building. And he was there to ride the elevator to the top floor to use a quote, colored restroom that was there. And something he did every day, and it was just normal. But in those days, elevators had elevator operators. They weren't automatic. So you had a 17-year-old white girl named Sarah Page was the operator. We think what happened is when Dick stepped onto the elevator, he tripped. He shot out his hands to break his fall. And when he did, he caught Sarah on the shoulder. She screamed. He ran out of the building. The police were summoned, but they didn't seem to be particularly upset about this. They didn't put out an all points bulletin. They didn't do anything. They did arrest him the next morning at his mother's home, brought him into the courthouse, a jail on the top floor. And, but the wheels of justice, even Jim Crow justice, seemed to be calmly turning. Sarah Page would never press charges. He was eventually exonerated, but the white afternoon daily newspaper in Tulsa caught wind of this, and they had this fantastic write-up of the incident on Tuesday afternoon, May 31st, with a front page story essentially claiming that Dick Rowland had been stalking Sarah Page, that he attempted to rape her, scratched her face, tore her clothes. But also in that same issue, in a now lost editorial that was titled "To Lynch Negro Tonight." And that was, a call to arms. And so the Tribune hit the streets at 3 o'clock. By 3:30 that afternoon, there was lynch talk on the streets of Tulsa. That soon led to a lynch mob gathering in front of the Tulsa County Courthouse where Dick Rowland was held. 100, 200, 300, 500, 800 whites who demanded of the white sheriff that they release Rowland to the mob. The sheriff refused. Meanwhile, word hit Greenwood that this young African-American was in mortal danger. And what happened is groups of African-American World War I vets, many of whom went on and went home and put on their uniforms, all of them were armed. A group of 25 of them at about 7:30 that night get in cars, they drive down to the courthouse, present themselves to the sheriff, and say, "We're here to help to protect the prisoner." And the sheriff says, "Get the hell out of here." They leave and go home, but their presence now just electrifies the white mob. Mob members now go home to get their own guns. One group tried to break into the National Guard armory. Others are getting others to come, and you have this tense situation going. And this is, and Tracy, just to remind everyone, there's no radio in those days, of course, no television, no internet. There's very few telephones, really. So it's a lot of word of mouth. And at around 10 o'clock that night, word hit Greenwood that the whites were storming the jail to get to Dick Rowland. It wasn't true, but this time 75 black vets get in cars, all armed, go down to the courthouse, repeat what they did before, present themselves to the sheriff, say, "We're here to help defend the prisoner." The sheriff sends them away. As they're leaving, an elderly white man tries to disarm a black vet. A shot goes off, and the worst incident of racial violence in American history begins at that point.
Yeah. And so for the next couple of days, or certainly all of that night and into the next day, one thing after another until Greenwood is destroyed. What happens from the time that shot is fired until things begin to calm down sometime on June 1st?
Well, I'll try to be brief. What happens first is, we don't know how many people are killed. There's a shootout at the courthouse. We're not sure how many people were killed. I don't think a lot, but some, others wounded. Meanwhile, the nearly all white Tulsa police force, who's been gone this entire time, now they show up. But rather than to try to disarm the white mob and send them home, instead they deputize members of the mob. White police officers also break into pawn shops and sporting goods stores to get access to the guns that are there. They hand those to members of the lynch mob and tell them to get a gun and get a Negro, in so many words. The mob, meanwhile, they don't even care about Dick Rowland anymore. And now they are consumed by this racial bloodlust, and they're out to kill any black person they can. And they kill a number in the downtown area of innocent African-Americans who are just getting off work and are tracked down, shot down in the streets, shot down in a movie theater, elsewhere. Gangs of whites in car. Meanwhile, the black vets sort of fight their way back to Greenwood. There's not a lot of street lights. It's dark. They get there fine. But carloads of whites start to make drive-by shootings in African-American residential neighborhoods, piling into cars, firing out of both sides of the cars into children's bedrooms and living rooms and parlors. There are a couple fires set along the edges of the black community. Also some that are, you know, a couple of people are murdered, we know of, early on. And then there's an attempt by groups of whites to invade the black business district, which is known as Deep Greenwood. It's called Black Wall Street now, but known as Deep Greenwood then. But they're repulsed by black property owners who are armed or firing back. So what happens is about 2 o'clock in the morning, it seems like everything's okay in the morning of June 1st. Everything starts to quiet down. Some African-Americans are already leaving town, going, you know, navigating by starlight out into the countryside. Others are probably unaware of what's happened. Still others are thinking, okay, everything's okay. But what they didn't realize is that whites were now organizing. So we know groups of white men are going into all-night cafes and speakeasies and getting people to gather at certain corners where men will jump up on the roofs of cars and say, we're going to invade at dawn. Make sure you've got guns. Make sure you've got plenty of ammunition, all that stuff. So while in black Tulsa, people are starting to relax, these white Tulsans are, you know, putting another cup of coffee on the stove to stay up all night before dawn. And so shortly before dawn on June 1st, there are literally thousands of whites that are gathered across from three sets of railroad tracks from Greenwood. A massacre survivor that I interviewed, in fact, he was the son of John and Lula Williams, who owned that three-story Williams building. He had helped, you know, his father defend Greenwood all night. He said right before dawn, you could look out across the tracks. And he said it looked like stars, consolation. It was all the glows of the cigarettes and cigars that these whites are smoking. Then the sun comes up, this strange whistle goes off, a factory whistle sort of that's been described. We don't know exactly what it is. That was the signal for these white mobs to start to invade, and they do. And it's fairly systematic how they go. If any African-Americans who resist, you know, with guns are going to be killed. Others are disarmed, and then they're marched away at gunpoint to these hastily created internment centers. And then while other African-Americans are fleeing, and then whites will break into businesses. They'll loot them and then they'll set them on fire. And it goes block by block by block. The Tulsa police force, meanwhile, is doing nothing to stop the white rioters. In fact, by arresting blacks to keep them from defending their homes, they're making it worse. The all-white local National Guard units have been mobilized, but they end up, you know, turning their machine guns on black citizens. They're a part of this as well. We also know that there were airplanes over Greenwood that day. There weren't a lot of airplanes in Tulsa in 1921, a handful, but there's credible evidence from black and white sources that they were there. And there's no question in my mind, at least one of the planes, people were dropping sticks of dynamite onto Greenwood. But it should be said that Greenwood was destroyed on the ground. Yeah. And so by early that afternoon, Greenwood is gone. I mean, we have 35 square blocks have been totally looted and burned to the ground. More than 1,000 homes and businesses destroyed. Finally, state troops from Oklahoma City, they arrive and restore order. National Guard, martial law is declared. But you have now 10,000 African Americans who are homeless, who are being held in these internment camps for a while. But, in a matter of 16 hours, Greenwood was completely destroyed.
I have a number of other questions for you, but I think it was worth taking the time to kind of set the scene so that everybody knows what took place there. But what is fascinating, Scott, is that as quickly as the events kicked off, over that Memorial Day weekend, they disappeared for a long, long time. I mean, you grew up in Tulsa and you wrote that you really didn't know a lot about this. I mean, why did nobody know about this?
Well, nobody knew about it because the story was actively suppressed in the white community for more than 50 years. So we know that. I mean, when the massacre happened, this was front page news all over the country, front page of the New York Times. It was in the Times of London. It was in the Times of India. And Tulsa's white city fathers, the businessmen and politicians who ran the city or trying to grow the city, realized they had a big PR problem. So they make this grandiose announcement that they're very sorry what happened, that the white community is going to rebuild the black community. They don't. And what they do instead is they try to steal the land where the Deep Greenwood commercial district was. Black lawyers fight that in court and are successful. But even in that first week after the riot, we have evidence that the Tulsa police chief instructed his officers to confiscate photographs of the massacre. We know at least there was a substantial box of photos that was still around as late as the 1970s that's now disappeared. Tulsa's white daily newspapers went to extreme lengths for a half century never to mention the massacre. You know, it's not taught in schools, and it was people, whites were told who moved to town from out of town, you know, this is just something we don't talk about. And so what happened is, even by as early as the 1940s, you had an entire generation of young white Tulsans who had never heard of this thing. The irony, though, Tracy, was that in the black community, it wasn't discussed publicly either. And not by everyone, but, and I think, you know, the Oklahoma Eagle, which was the city's, has long been the flagship black newspaper in Tulsa, they didn't mention it for until the late 1960s. But there are a lot of survivors, I think you need to think of them like Holocaust survivors, that these people, they had undergone such horrific traumatic incidents, still suffering from PTSD decades later, and they just didn't want to burden their children and grandchildren with these horrible memories. And they didn't talk about it. So for 50 years, the story was buried, and it's taken us about 50 years to get the story out again.
And during all of that time, there were people who were sort of quietly pursuing the story and trying to put the pieces together. You were one of those people starting in your college days when you were working on your thesis. And you write about how you, at one point, used old city directories and you reconstructed a map of what Greenwood looked like. And you were speaking with a gentleman named W.D. Williams, I believe his name was. And you talked about how he really shifted your understanding about what took place and why it happened. Tell us a little bit about him and that meeting and how your understanding of things changed from that conversation.
Well, that was the day everything changed. Certainly my life changed. I also think in a certain way, our understanding of the massacre changed. But I had come back during the summer of 1975 to research the history of the massacre. And I just couldn't find anything. All these records had been destroyed and stolen. You know, National Guard reports, other official records were long gone. There were these sort of sugar-coated versions in, you know, these local histories. And I knew that I just couldn't figure out how you had this tiny incident, seemingly small incident, an elevator turns into this racial holocaust. And I'd heard about this gentleman. I'd never done an oral history interview before, named W.D. Williams. He was the son of John and Lula Williams. And I'd heard that he knew a lot about the massacre. So I called him up and asked if I could come in and interview him. And the fact was, is that he had been waiting all of his life to tell his story, but nobody had come. And he sure as heck wasn't waiting for me, some white nobody, you know, 21-year-old from South Tulsa. But he invited me in and our interview sort of started stiffly. But then I had made this map of the Greenwood Commercial District, and I had written down, I'd gotten old street maps, and I'd written down where every business was, everyone who lived there, that, you know, that the photography studio was next door to, you know, to Mabel Little's restaurant, upstairs the Jones family lived, and I'd written all this stuff out, and I pulled the map out, and I put it on, and we spread it out on his kitchen table. And I'm sort of yammering on about how I'd made it. He's not paying any attention. he's just looking at this thing, and he gets a smile, and then he shakes his head, and he goes, I mean, there were just dozens and dozens of notations I put in there, and he goes through every one, and I realized that this just wasn't a map of Deep Greenwood. It was a map of his childhood, and there were people he hadn't thought about in a long time. And finally, he just sits up, and he looks at me and says, okay, so tell me what it is you want to know. And that was the breakthrough, because he had been everywhere at the right place at the right time. He had read the Tulsa Tribune, seen that front page article, which had been cut out later, read the editorial to Lynch a Negro Tonight. He had been in his family's Dreamland Theater when a black vet jumped on stage and said, shut this place down. We ain't going to let this lynching happen here. He had watched the other 75 black vets get in their cars to go downtown. All that horrible night of May 31st, June 1st, he helped he loaded his father's 30-30 rifle and repeating shotgun as his dad is protecting Greenwood. And then he saw the white mob came. So he was the one who put it all together. And then when I came back 3 summers later to turn that thesis into a book, he connected me with other elderly massacre survivors, all of whom had been adults in 1921. I don't think any of them had ever done an oral history interview. I don't think most of them had not even told their family members, but they took a chance. It didn't have to be me. It just turned out to be me, but God bless them. You know, I became their witness, but it's really because they were willing to share that we really know what happened.
Yeah. What did you learn from him about why this happened? Because there were theories that it was a land grab, that it was, you know, jealousy over the financial success of the Greenwood neighborhood, that it was just garden variety racism. What conclusion did you come to about why this took place?
Well, I learned a lot from him. And it was interesting after he looked at the map, I didn't mean to test him, but in a way I did. In the New York Times, there had been an account a few days after the massacre that claimed that right before the massacre happened, handbills had appeared in Greenwood warning African-Americans to leave. And I saw that, oh, that's it. The whole thing was pre-planned, whatnot. And so the first question I said, well, Mr. Williams, tell me about those handbills. He says, what are you talking about? And there weren't any handbills. They didn't exist at all. And then I realized, I later determined that handbills had been placed in a different town in Oklahoma around the same time. And the editors of the New York Times had conflated those two stories. But, you know, I think that he really had the sequence of events. And he also, amongst the other people he helped introduce me to, was a man named Robert Fairchild. Robert Fairchild was friends with Dick Rowland. He had worked as a shoe shiner with him. He knew him well. He said, there's a lot of myths about how this all happened. And he said, you know, Dick Rowland would never have had anything to do with a white woman. He would never have attacked her. They weren't secret lovers. So those people back then just gave us a lot of kind of really down to earth information about where they were and what they saw. I mean, I think that there was some jealousy or some resentment, certainly resentment that African-Americans in Greenwood, that a small portion were doing well, but white people didn't go to Greenwood in 1921, and not that many people knew about it on a certain level.
Yeah. So fast forward several decades, and eventually a riot commission is formed, and you're part of that as an historian. And there were a number of questions that commission was trying to answer. Whatever came of that?
So I was asked to be the lead scholar along with John Hope Franklin for the Tulsa Race Riot Commission, a state commission formed in 1997, lasted until roughly 2000-2001. A lot happened during that. We began the search for the mass graves during that period, but more importantly, the commission itself, a majority of the members voted that massacre survivors and their descendants should receive a form of reparations, a financial restitution for what they had lost. And at that point, we had about 150 identified massacre survivors still alive, almost all of whom had been children during the massacre, but we knew them and who they were. They made that recommendation to the Oklahoma State Governor and state legislature. And they turned it down. They wouldn't pay a penny. Instead, they gave each survivor a gold-plated medal.
Yeah. And so the commission and the search eventually was shut down for probably about 20 years, until Mayor Bynum sort of started things up again. And so we've been following that, of course, as the story has become better known, and the search for mass graves has been a big headline. Can you tell us, you know, where we are in that search? Because I know that there have been some findings even recently.
Yeah, so we've just completed our second excavation in Oaklawn Cemetery, which was a city-owned cemetery that still is. It predated the massacre. 20 years ago, we found funeral home records that proved that at least 18 identified and unidentified African-American massacre victims were buried by white funeral homes in the cemetery. They didn't tell us where, though. We found these in old ledgers. And all the cemetery maps prior to the 1930s are gone. So we've completed a second dig. We haven't. I don't believe that we found those 18 yet. But this is difficult work. I mean, we have very little evidence to go on. We do have some high tech tools, ground penetrating radar, and whatnot. But we still have a ways to go, and there are at least two other sites in town where I am completely confident the evidence is very, very strong that massacre victims were, in one case, buried in a trench dug by a steam shovel. Whether we have the technology to find that or not, we'll have to wait and see. But I think we're in the opening stages of something that I hope is going to continue for some time.
And did I see recently that there were remains found of someone with multiple
gunshot wounds,
right?
Yeah, there are. And my suspicion is that this is a massacre victim. You know, we know the names of some of those 18. So we can extract DNA, for example, from that individual's remains and see if we can link that with any descendants of the part of the 18 that we can identify or not. So this is going to take a while. You know, it's a we've been at it now for 23 years, even though most of the time we were shut down. But this is work this is pioneering work. I mean, the reality is this is unprecedented. This is the first time a unit of American government at any level has purposefully gone searching to recover and identify, rebury, and properly memorialize victims of racist violence. I mean, people have been found, accidentally over the years, but this is a brand new search, and so we're in untrodden territory.
Can you talk a little bit, Scott, about what this has been like for you? Because you have been working on this for pretty much all of your adult life. You've come to know these people intimately, not only survivors, but their descendants. And you've watched these searches take place and stood there and waited, hoping something would happen. And many times nothing came of it. Just talk about the experience of sort of riding this roller coaster with these families for all these years.
Well, it is a roller coaster, but I was so blessed as a young man, particularly in the 70s, but also in the 1990s later on when I was older, to get to know a number of these survivors really well and spending a lot of time with them. I got the better end of the deal. I learned a lot more from them than they ever got from me. But this was, they were a greatest generation of their own. I mean, they had survived this horrific event as young people. They had come of age during Jim Crow. They had married. They'd started their careers. And then, in late middle age, they had, watched with wonder and joy and support the civil rights movement. They'd seen a lot of things. They'd seen desegregation to a certain degree and things like that. And they taught me patience. I mean, they taught me the importance of keeping at it and don't stop something that's worthwhile, but also things take time. Whenever, we've broken ground looking for this or something like that, I've really thought about them. And part of my mission is to keep their story alive and the story of their families and their community life. And I'm just honored to have been able to do that.
Yeah. Speaking of keeping at it, you mentioned reparations just a few minutes ago, and I was reading that the three remaining survivors testified not too long ago before a congressional subcommittee about reparations. What can you tell us about that, and what might that look like?
Well, I think it's, we've got, I think, first of all, let me go back and say that, you know, at first, you know, well, let's put it this way. In the 1990s, the survivors I knew well convinced me that without a question, the reparations were right. And I've been on that bandwagon ever since. There's no question whatsoever in my mind that survivors or and descendants deserve some form of financial restitution. You know, these people were, not only did their neighbors try to kill them, and killed some of their loved ones, but their city government let them down, the state government let them down, the federal government let them down. There was never even an official investigation of the massacre. Insurance companies refused to play black policyholders for their claims. And we just can't act like this injustice didn't happen. And something needs to be done. There won't be enough money. There's no question about that. But the impact of this, I'll answer a little more of your question, but, you know, there was a study recently by National Geographic in terms of how much generational wealth was lost in Greenwood because of the massacre. And again, this is a small community, relatively speaking, but they figured that if the massacre had not happened, there would have been an additional $600 million worth of wealth in Greenwood today. That's generations of college tuition, down payment on houses, seed money for businesses, elder care, health insurance, all of these things. And the disparities economically between Black and white Tulsa are very, very severe today. So there's no question that needs to happen. How is it going to happen? That's a good question. You know, I think it's important to remember that Oklahoma is a very conservative state. There's no way in the world that the state government at this point is going to vote for it. I don't think the city government in Tulsa would right now. I think the only hope right now, and there's a lawsuit out there, if that's successful, that changes the dynamic. But I think it would have to be from private citizens in Tulsa and elsewhere, or from the federal government. But this is something that needs to be done. And it's not an easy issue. I mean, reparations it's very complicated, but there's just no question in the case of Tulsa, this needs to happen. Yeah.
Before we go to questions from our audience, just one more quick question, and that is about President Biden's visit to Tulsa on the 100th anniversary. What were your thoughts about that as you watched the first sitting president visit that site not long ago?
Oh, it was just a great thrill. I was, the White House invited me to the event. I got to meet the president. That was a great thrill. But his speech was just fantastic. It was a terrific speech. It was heartfelt. And this sounds like a broken record, but it's true, Tracy. I kept thinking about how proud some of these survivors, these men and women that I had known, you know, decades earlier, how much that would have meant to them. It was the right thing to happen, and I'm really glad that it did.
Yeah. Well, on that note, we'll take some questions from our audience. Margaret asks, how is this book different from your other book on the Tulsa Race Massacre?
Sure. That's a really great question. So my first book was really, it was the first comprehensive history of the massacre. And while I've never written, you know, most college professors write for other college professors. I don't do that. I've always written for a general audience, but it has footnotes. I wanted to make sure all the evidence is there. So it's really the story of the massacre and how it happened as I understood it in 1982. The current book was actually my literary agent's idea. And I realized that not only had anyone really written about how the story of the massacre was suppressed for so long, but also about these really courageous people, Black and white, who really kept the story alive and helped to do it. And just because I've been at it for so long, I realized I'm one of the few people who knew it. And I thought, well, I better write this down. But I also wanted to write the story of our search for the graves and what it is we did, with the hope that maybe other people in other communities might be able to use those. You know, we have victims of racial violence that are buried in unmarked graves all over this country. And we're not going to find most of them, but there's some that we might be able to find. And as in the case of Tulsa, hopefully rebury and memorialize with honor. And I wanted to write about reparations. Writing the book, I have to tell you, was a little tricky because I didn't want to write about myself, but I was so much a part of the story that at times I had to.
Here's a question from Ellen, who says, do you think the popularization of Birth of a Nation, released 1915 or 16, she says, since it popularized the Ku Klux Klan, do you think that that contributed to the massacre and to other similar incidents?
Oh, absolutely. No question at all. The Tulsa case is a little funny, though, in that we do not know to this day whether the Klan was organized in Tulsa prior to the massacre. The evidence seems to suggest that they did later. We know who the actual organizers were who came to Oklahoma, when they were in Oklahoma City, when they came to Tulsa and whatnot. Tulsa became a huge Klan center after the massacre. I mean, one of the biggest in the country. They had multiple, they had their own hall. They built a big brick hall. Tulsa was one of the cities. They had a ladies auxiliary. It was one of the few cities in the United States where they had a Children of the Ku Klux Klan chapter. There were Klan parades. I mean, it was gigantic, but there's no question that Birth of a Nation was a part of all of this venomous, militant white racism that was, you know, soaring all over the country. I mean, you know, racism was taught, it was part of the curriculum at Harvard and Yale, here at the University of Michigan, all over. I mean, that was part of it. There's no question that that's a part of it in the way that African Americans were portrayed, particularly Black men as always desiring white women. And that was for any of these racial incidents, that's just what drove white people just absolutely crazy. And that's where these horrific, you know, burnings and lynchings happened. But certainly that you're exactly right, Ellen, Birth of a Nation is a huge factor in that.
A question from Tim, and this goes back to your other book, Death in a Promised Land. And Tim references Jason's introduction and asks, could you talk about the moment that you felt like this part of our history hit the tipping point and became part of the larger consciousness after so many years of obscurity?
Yeah, I write about it in the new book, but the tipping point really was the Oklahoma City bombing in 1995. You know, this is pre 9/11. This was, you know, the Murrah Federal Building. I can't remember, 175 people died, something like that. This was at that point the so-called worst incident of terrorism in American history. But when that happened, the Today Show flew its entire crew from New York City to broadcast live from Oklahoma City for a week. And this is, you know, the networks are very powerful then, you know, the internet really isn't happening yet. During that week, and the Today Show was hosted by Bryant Gumbel, the first African-American, you know, national network TV host. During that week, Don Ross, who was an activist, a journalist, he had written about the massacre in the late 60s for Tulsa's Black newspaper. He was now an Oklahoma State legislator. He came up to Brian Gumbel and said, as horrible as this bombing is, there's another story that's never really been told or given the attention it needs to. And Ross gave Gumbel a copy of Death in a Promised Land. 10 days later, Ross and I both got calls from producers of the Today Show who told us in 1996, the Today Show would do a story about the massacre. And aside from an op-ed in the Washington Post in 1982 when Death in a Promised Land came out, that was the first national news story about the massacre since the 1920s. This was a huge breakthrough. So people in Tulsa organized, built a memorial, Black Wall Street Memorial and whatnot, but they filmed a bunch of interviews with survivors. They interviewed me. But maybe 2 weeks before the story aired, I realized, well, shoot, if the Today Show's doing a story, maybe I can leverage that to get other groups. So I got on the phone, and in a week, I got the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Associated Press, National Public Radio, and I think UPI was still in existence, all to do stories. And that was a breakthrough because we, you know, front page, the Washington Post, big story in the New York Times, all that. But then Don Ross used those stories to go to the state legislature and governor and got them to create the riot commission. So one thing built on the other, but there's no question that the Today Show story in 1996, that was when we really finally had a big breakthrough.
So Laura has a question that's a good follow-up to that. And she says, can you talk about how this incident lately seems to be included in a lot of pop culture, specifically sci-fi, for example, Watchmen and Lovecraft Country? Is there something about this that is so extreme that it seems to want to be contextualized in such ways?
Well, I think you're right. And I think you probably know a lot more than I do about how to explain that. But you know, and I have to say that Watchmen in particularly has been one of the most important moments in terms of getting this story out. When that first episode aired, I mean, I heard from people in the UK and Scandinavia and Shanghai, others, you know, reaching out, why haven't I heard of it? And I think it's because, you know, to this day, I mean, it's just barely getting into the history books now, frankly. And people just cannot believe they have not heard this story. And that is so incredibly powerful. And, you know, there's, you know, graphic novels, there's children's books, there's a, you know, a hip hop album, musicals, plays, you know, it's really caught the imagination of something about our hidden history. And of course, the murder of George Floyd plays a huge role in this. Mm-hmm. And as that really created, you know, an inflection point in this country as we talk about race, and I think it started to open minds about what are the things that we don't really know. You know, a lot of these important books, you know, that are out there now talking about that. And I think the massacre has really caught people's attention in some ways that some other events have not.
Question from Andy, who says, hi, Scott, thanks so much for your tireless effort to ensure this story is known and remembered. Amidst the conservative backlash against teaching about racism, why do you think it's important for history students to learn about the Tulsa Race Massacre?
Well, it's important for all of us. Look, I mean, you know, our history is, you know, it can be a guide to help us understand how to act in the future, how to live our lives today. You know, reading the stories about Americans in the past of all backgrounds, of all, you know, experiences is such a valuable thing. It's such a valuable thing to teach our students. But here's the deal. You have to teach the whole thing. You can't just teach the good and the bad. I mean, I'm just sort of flabbergasted. I mean, you know, I can, as a graduate of public schools in Oklahoma, I can tell you that Oklahoma school children can handle tough topics. They can handle learning about Pearl Harbor and 9/11 and slavery and the Trail of Tears and the Tulsa Race Massacre. And I think that's true of children all over the country. And obviously you want to teach things at appropriate age levels and things like that. But look, the only way we can learn from our history is to learn it all. And that's why it's so important to do.
Yeah. James says, thank you for your lifetime of work. Could you update the status of the September 2020 public nuisance lawsuit against Tulsa City, County, and the Oklahoma National Guard? I learned of the massacre, but very little of it, soon before I did my own legal internship in Greenwood in 1983 and 84 with Jim Goodwin.
Oh, that's great. Well, I Jim Goodwin is still going strong, incidentally. He was at the president's speech. We exchanged messages on, you know, Facebook and stuff like that. He's just a giant, absolutely. And in fact, I interviewed his dad. He was also one of the survivors I interviewed back in the 1970s. You know, I know that this very ambitious lawsuit has been filed. The trick of it is, in Oklahoma, there's something called a nuisance law. So there had been a lawsuit in 2003, 2005, filed by Charles Ogletree of the Harvard Law School on behalf of the 150 or so survivors. The problem with, and that lawsuit made it all the way to the United States Supreme Court, but the Supreme Court would not hear it. The problem with that lawsuit and the problem with any lawsuits is how you get over the statute of limitations. Because while there's no statute of limitations for murder, you know, how can you reclaim property and whatnot by doing that. And in Oklahoma, there's something called a nuisance law, which says as long as something, a nuisance still exists, the statute of limitations doesn't start ticking again. And so there had been a successful lawsuit in Oklahoma against Johnson & Johnson over manufacturing of OxyContin and whatnot, leading to the opioid crisis, using this, even though it was beyond the statute of limitations, using this nuisance law approach. So we'll just have to see. I know it's percolating in the courts. I don't know how far they are, whether they've gotten to discovery or those other, you know, legal hurdles. My guess is it'll be a tough case to win, but we'll just have to wait and see. Yeah.
Well, we have a question here, and it is, let me see if I can find it now, from Dustin. And I think this is a good one for us to wrap on. Dustin says, thanks for your thorough investigation of the massacre and bringing all of these details to light and for this important conversation. Going another direction, do you have a favorite John Hope Franklin story that you can share?
Oh, God.
Dustin says he saw him at the library a number of years ago and felt honored to be in his presence.
Well, I do. And John Hope and I can tell you, we were very good friends for over 30 years. My son, Johnny, is named after him. But my favorite story was in the night, I tell about it in the groundbreaking. Here's the commercial here. Sometime I think in about the 1980s, I ended up meeting him in San Francisco at a historical convention. I picked him up at the airport. My family out there was visiting, and took him to the St. Francis Hotel in San Francisco, right on Union Square. And we go up and he checks in, and his bag is given to an elderly bell captain. And we ride up, with the elevator with the elderly African-American bell captain to the room. The bell captain opens the door and says, oh no, this won't do. And he says, wait here. And he locks the door and he disappears down the elevator. And then he comes back about 5 or 10 minutes later and says, we're going to go to this room because this room overlooks the square and it has really beautiful light in the morning. And I had seen this a lot with elderly African-Americans who realized if they didn't know exactly who he was, he knew here was a man who was on their side. And this man was determined to treat him well. I can tell you about trying to walk a city block in Manhattan with John O. Franklin. It took about 4 times longer because people would just come out of the, I know who you are, you're that historian. And they just wanted to meet him and thank him. But I mean, he was a legend like few others.
Oh, without a doubt. Well, Professor Scott Ellsworth, it has been such a delight to talk with you and to really get a better understanding of this important story that so few of us knew really much of anything about until the last couple of years. And you have enlarged our understanding of it. So thank you so much for this book and for making time to talk with us tonight.
Tracy, it's just been such an honor to be interviewed by you. Thank you so much. And thanks all y'all in the audience. Your questions were just superb.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.